Good morning, Mr. Goad.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, how are you?
Fine.
Now, Mr. Goad, as I think you know by now, we had granted Ms. Adelfio's, given her physical condition, her request to participate by way of conference call. So I will go ahead and do my best to attempt to get her on the line now.
Yes, sir. And you're welcome to approach the bench if you can't hear her.
Yeah, because it doesn't look like there's a great place for me to just rest this on the rail. Let's see. I think I should just leave it here and crank the volume all the way.
Let's see how it goes.
This is Kate Adelfio.
Good morning, Ms. Adelfio. It's Judge Attlee. How are you?
Oh, I'm very fine. How are you, Judge Attlee?
Very well, thank you. I am here with both Judge Humphreys and Judge Clements, and I also, just a stone's throw away, we have Mr. Goad, and we are ready to begin on the case of Campbell versus Commonwealth, if you are.
Of course, Your Honor, and thank you again for accommodating my request to appeal here by phone. I know that was probably an inconvenience for the court, and I appreciate it.
Well, we hope that you're doing well physically with your impending delivery.
Thank you, Your Honor. Everything seems to be normal, but I'm very glad I did not have to drive to Lexington today.
I can imagine. Now, I'd like to just do a little test run, if we may, Ms. Adelfio. I'm going to get Mr. Goad to speak in his tip, then we will see what we can do about rearranging either the players or the telephone.
Of course, Your Honor.
Mr. Goad?
Good morning, Ms. Adelfio. Can you hear me okay?
I can, thank you.
Okay, great. All right. Well, you can begin at your leisure, Mr. Goad. Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, sir, Your Honor. 3 minutes, please.
Okay, thank you.
May it please the Court, my name is Robert Goad, and I represent James Campbell, Sr. On his appeal of a conviction of manufacturing methamphetamine. The overarching issue in this appeal is one of suppression of the evidence. That is the primary driving thrust of the appeal. By way of background, initially, before...
Well, let me interrupt you, Mr. Goad, and see if we can cut to the chase here, because we're familiar with the facts. But what we have here, at least initially, is a statutory requirement that a search warrant affidavit be filed within a certain amount of time after the magistrate issues it. And what happened, the statute itself provides, or at least implicitly seems to provide, for an exclusionary remedy if the statute is not followed. I'm setting aside the constitutional issues for a moment, the exigent circumstances. If the purpose of the statute is to provide notice, and I think we can all agree that the officer did nothing wrong here. The problem was the magistrate issued the warrant, and the record to me isn't really crystal clear, but either faxed or somehow electronically transmitted the warrant and the affidavit to the circuit court clerk's office, and only one page ever made it through and therefore was filed. So I guess my first question is, the officer didn't do anything wrong. The exclusionary remedy typically is a sanction against the officer for something, but here it's specific, it seems broader, I would suggest, and I don't think you would disagree. But nonetheless, an attempt was made to comply with the law, and apparently nobody realized until much later that whatever was transmitted wasn't entirely received. So I guess the question really comes down to what extent, assuming it was a partial transmission, whether that is sufficient to satisfy the purpose of the statute, which is notice to your client that a search warrant has been issued. Now, here he was given a copy of the warrant as well. So I guess the question would be, the statute wasn't perfectly complied with. I don't think there's any question about that. But the question is the exclusionary remedy available when the affidavit was partially filed and through no fault of anything but a machine, apparently, I don't know whether somebody ran out of paper or there was a defect in the fax machine or whatever, the complete document wasn't received by the circuit court clerk. Do you want to address that?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, assuming arguendo that 19.254 does supply that exclusionary right, it's not explicitly spelled out, that's my position that it does, otherwise that language wouldn't be in there. But really the purpose of notice is not to have some copy of an affidavit that an officer keeps or something that was prepared possibly before or after the actual affidavit was supplied to the magistrate. The purpose is to know that the affidavit on file in the clerk's office, the required affidavit by the statute is the one upon which the search warrant was issued. The purpose of that, and while it is a statutory right, there are constitutional reasons for the filing of the affidavit in the clerk's office. Notice alone by an extraneous copy by what the officer had is not enough, I would argue, to satisfy the requirement necessary in the statute and the constitutional requirements. Additionally, and I agree the record is not perfectly clear, but there are two affidavits, one kind of the middle way through the record and the other at the very end of the record where the exhibits are, and they have changes that are different in each one. And I would submit to the court that while not something that was done maliciously by the officer, but that is a perfect example of why the exclusionary rule should apply in this case. Because when we have different affidavits, one that isn't certified and one that is, with different changes on them, and there is no way for us to know what the actual second page that was filed by the magistrate said, then we're not able to say with certainty that my client was given the appropriate notice as required by the statute. And as a result of that, that's when the exclusionary rule would kick in, because the purpose of the statute would be defeated. Did that answer the court's question?
Well, I think it was it Lockhart or Garza, I can't remember which. The Supreme Court held that the notice requirement was satisfied even though it was filed in the wrong circuit court.
That's correct.
And it seems to me this situation is somewhat analogous, or at least would seem at least to be somewhat analogous to that situation where, the defendant didn't have actual notice but had constructive notice, I guess. And certainly, it's not difficult to check by going to the courthouse and determining if the affidavit is the same or the warrant is the same, or if there's, some material difference. And if it turns out there is, raise the issue immediately. In this case, apparently it wasn't discovered until either shortly before trial or even immediately before trial that there was a problem with what was sent by the magistrate, because everybody has a copy of what nobody is suggesting is a invalid warrant. It just simply wasn't filed properly through no fault of anything but the malfunction of a machine.
Correct, but there's no second page of the affidavit on file in the clerk's office. I believe the second page in the record, which is not certified by the magistrate, is what the investigating officer had. So there's no way for the appellant, for Mr. Campbell or myself, to know with certainty what that second page said. We certainly have notice of what Investigator Begley testified to was what he put on the affidavit, and I believe that was signed by the magistrate. However, we do not have the second page of what the magistrate certified and delivered. Attempted to deliver to the clerk's office by way of the second page. And I think that's really the thrust of our argument is that, and I don't want to jump ahead of the court, but really the purpose of notice and the purpose of the exclusionary rule, not just in the statutory construct, but also in the constitutional construct, is to not only punish police officers that do bad things with affidavits, and that's not what we're implying in this case, but also to deter future misconduct by the police. And that's really what the purpose of
having... What's the deterrent effect of applying that here in the abstract, since apparently nobody did anything wrong?
Well, it would prevent any unscrupulous officers in the future or even unknowing or negligent officers in the future from having that second page of the affidavit come in at a later date or not be filed, or an unscrupulous magistrate. And I don't want to, when I'm arguing, I don't want to set the wrong tone with the court that I think this is something that would happen, but could possibly happen, a negligent act that does
well,
not.
Probably if there's bad faith, evidence of bad faith on the part of a police officer, or even a magistrate who's acting improperly, that's one thing. But where there's no evidence that anybody did a thing wrong, everybody did exactly by the book, and the only evidence that we can discern from the record of any fault here is basically a machinery fault, a fault on the part of a fax machine that didn't operate properly.
Well, Well, that is one of the issues. The other issue that I pointed out is that there are things being changed between the two affidavits. Now, I don't think they're very substantive in this case. I think it was the addition of the city in addition to the street name. But there was a discrepancy between the two affidavits that we had, the two first pages of the affidavits that we had, the one that was filed in the clerk's office and the one that Investigator Begley retained. So in that vein, we can see where if changes are being made to an affidavit to allow a second affidavit to come in which have different changes or more changes, that erodes our confidence in what exactly the magistrate had in front of him at the time he issued the search warrant. And that really is why the exclusionary rule in both instances, constitutionally and statutorily, should be applied in this case. And that would have a deterrent effect in the future of keeping officers from making changes.
Do we even need to reach the constitutional issue in this case?
I would submit, my argument is that I would ask the court to consider it. Yes, sir.
Well, but my point is we don't decide constitutional issues if we don't have to. The only way we'd ever get to the constitutional issue would be if somehow we determined that the statute didn't apply.
The exclusionary rule.
Right.
Did not apply. Yes, sir, I can certainly, if the court agrees with my argument on the issue of the statutory exclusion, then correct me, John.
I didn't mean to cut off Judge Atlee.
No. I'm glad you followed up on that.
But I think that while there is a statutory exclusionary rule, the case law interpreting 19.2-54 insinuates that the purposes of 19.2-54 and the requirements of 19.2-54 are the same as the Fourth Amendment. It's not verbatim, but the purposes drive the same issue. So I think to look at 19.2-54 as written in a vacuum may miss the entire point of the purpose of the statute and why we need to exclude things when we don't.
Well, I'm not sure that really helps your argument, quite honestly, because if we agreed with you that the statute is essentially congruent with the Constitution, the good faith exception where, here there's no evidence anybody acted in anything but good faith, that would seem to undercut your argument, it seems to me, if that's the way you want to go.
Well, again, I don't want to backtrack too much, but I think that it's a, as the court pointed out, an either or. If we can resolve the issue with just the statute, then we don't need to reach the constitutional argument. But again, and I can jump to the good faith exception if the court would like me to.
Mr. Good, one question I have for you. Assume that there are exigent circumstances here. With that assumption in mind, does that end it?
No, sir, not in my mind.
Why not?
I searched. I always hesitate to say that I can't find something because I'm always worried that I miss something. But in my research, I could not find in Virginia jurisprudence where a court has said that exigent circumstances save a defective affidavit in valid search warrant or valid violation of the statute.
So am I to understand your position in this, that if there were exigent circumstances and somebody didn't try to err on the side of caution and get a warrant, that the exigent circumstances are obviously fine, but because someone goes out, may perhaps errs on the side of caution, gets a warrant, if that warrant turns out to possibly be defective, the exigent circumstances cannot be relied upon? Wouldn't that create mischief?
Well, I think in my notes, the two main reasons that I have for why we shouldn't allow exigent circumstances to save defective warrants is, one, the whole purpose of the exigent circumstances exception is to validate searches where there's no time to get a warrant, not to allow the saving of a defective search warrant.
And there could be times where there are exigent circumstances and there is time to get a warrant, but somebody's concerned that it may not work out very well if you take the time to do that.
Certainly. And I would just add, as a supplementary, if we were to also allow the exigent circumstances to save any issue with the facts in this case being outside of the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule, that would also kind of add a fit prong to the basis for the good faith, the basis for taking facts outside of the four prongs of the good faith exception to the exclusion, if that makes sense. I believe I deviated a little bit from that.
No, I understand.
But it would add that fifth prong to the four prongs of when we can assume the good faith exception is not applied.
I know we've worked you into your rebuttal time, and I'm going to give you a little bit of extra time given how much of your argument we've taken up. But at this point, would you like to allow the remaining time for rebuttal, or is there any other points you'd like to make?
Thank you.
Ms. Adelfio?
Thank you, Your Honor. To address Judge Humphrey's first point, Code Section 19.2-54 does not require that the evidence be excluded. As Judge Humphrey's noted, there was no evidence that the officers acted in bad faith. And the appellate courts in Virginia have repeatedly found that evidence is admissible when the notice-based requirements of 19.2-54 are satisfied. The purpose of 19.2-54 is to give a defendant a reasonable opportunity to determine that an affidavit on file is the same one upon which the finding of probable cause was based.
Ms. Adelfio?
Sir.
Judge Humphreys, I'm looking at the statute, and the last paragraph of the statute says, failure of the officer issuing such warrant to file the, and by the way, officer appeared, it doesn't refer to the police officer, it refers to the magistrate.
Yes, Your Honor.
Failure of the officer issuing such warrant to file the required affidavit shall not invalidate any search made under the warrant unless such failure shall continue for a period of 30 days. Now, here, the failure did continue beyond 30 days, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Well, why isn't a fair reading of that, even though it's not expressly stated? It seems to me it's a completely fair inference to draw that if the search is invalid, if the statute is complied with within 30 days, then inferentially it is invalid if it's not complied within 30 days. How do you have us get around the language of the statute?
Your Honor, I'd state that because, because the statute doesn't expressly state that it must be invalidated, it only gives the option that it can be invalidated, that the invalidation is not a requirement. And if the General Assembly had wished to mandate that requirement, they could have done so. We look to the plain language of the statute, and in this case where they chose the language that they did, it's fair to look at only what the express language in the statute mandates. And here there is not an express statutory provision for suppression, as discussed in cases like Janus, which I cited on brief.
Why is that language there, then?
I think it provides the court with an option to invalidate the warrant, but it does not state that it must be invalidated. So hypothetically, if the court in this case had found that the failure was purposeful or in some set of circumstances the court could have chosen to invalidate the warrant.
Well, okay. I don't want to belabor the point, but it just seems to me if the General Assembly had wanted the court to have that kind of latitude, it could have said that as well.
And Ms. Adelfio, this is Judge Clements. The trial court in this case did determine that the statute had not been complied with and that there was no exclusionary rule, didn't it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Could you repeat the last part?
Yes, and that there was no exclusionary rule in the statute and then applied Fourth Amendment principles of exigent circumstances?
Well, Your Honor, the court did apply the exigent circumstances exception, as you noted, and I would suggest that to the extent it did that, then it had to find that it basically flip-flopped and found that there was not an express statutory provision for its suppression, given the fact that the court is the way this turned out.
Well, let me follow up on Judge Clement's question, because it seems to me the trial court concluded that the statute was violated and found a constitutional way to admit the evidence anyway.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, Couple of points to raise with that. One is the obvious question that the trial court relied on exigent circumstances, and one of the key factors in whether you have exigent circumstances is whether you have time to get a warrant. And clearly here they had time to get a warrant because they actually did get a warrant. That's number one. And then number two is that where you have, certainly the states can be more strict than the Constitution if they choose to be. So if, in fact, this the violation of this statutory requirement involves a statutory exclusionary rule, the evidence is excluded if it's not complied with, then that would trump admissibility under any other constitutional exception, including exigent circumstances, wouldn't it?
Your Honor, I would note that, I would again reiterate that the appellate courts in Virginia have repeatedly found that as long as the notice based requirements of 19.2-54 are satisfied, that the evidence is not suppressed.
Well, how was it set? I'm sorry, I think I cut off this point.
That would go to the question then of the trial court erring in determining that the violation of the statute required exclusion, correct?
That's right, correct, Your Honor. I think that the court made a number of, some of the court's rulings were contradictory. For example, the circuit court thought that the availability of the affidavit was dispositive to his ability to make a good faith finding. That is not the analysis. The court was entitled to look at the totality of the circumstances, including the affiant's testimony regarding what he told the magistrate and the fact that the affiant had a copy of an affidavit which was signed by the magistrate, dated and the time was noted as the same time at which the search warrant was issued. The court was making a number of contradictory findings and rulings throughout the course of both the suppression portion of the hearing and the actual trial.
So what would you say the trial court got right, or what did the trial court get wrong?
I would say that the trial court got right that there was probable cause. The trial court was correct that exigent circumstances did exist. And I would just note briefly that in 2011, the Supreme Court of the United States held in Kentucky versus King that just because there is an opportunity to obtain a warrant and a warrant is not obtained, that does not necessitate the refusal to apply the exigent circumstances exception.
Well, let me follow up on the point, or maybe just ask it this way. How do you respond to Mr. Gould that the notice requirement here was not satisfied, given that only a partial affidavit was ever filed?
Your Honor, I would suggest that given the fact that there was a hearing, the affiant was able to testify at the hearing that he, in fact, Campbell elicited this testimony, that the Begley's copy was as accurate and was the same as the one that, let me back up. Campbell tried to impeach Begley with the affidavit that Begley still possessed. And that's at appendix page 189. And so Campbell used that affidavit that Begley possessed in the course of his own case. I would also suggest that Begley testified that he gave all the information in the affidavit that he maintained to the magistrate. And again, he possessed a copy of an affidavit which was signed by the magistrate, dated August 6th, and with the time entered at 10:50 p.m. And that's at appendix page 59 through 60. And so certainly the court was entitled, or the court found that what the court explicitly said was, I have no doubt that Begley testified before the magistrate, and the magistrate issued a warrant given this testimony under oath.
Well, I think the problem here, if you can address it, Ms. Adelfio, is simply that the issue is not whether probable cause existed or didn't exist. That's a separate question. The question is, we've got this statutory scheme that clearly, based on all the case law, is intended to put a an individual on notice when a search warrant is issued against them, that has in fact occurred, and to permit them to have knowledge of exactly. The magistrate can't testify, obviously. The magistrate can't be a witness. So the only way to get the information in front of the individual whose place is searched or thing is seized is to give them a copy of the warrant and affidavit. Now, that was done here. The problem is we know there were at least some changes to the affidavit. And whether they were material or not, the problem is we have to wait until there's a suppression hearing and somebody testifies and a determination is made as to whether that testimony is credible or not to determine what else was in the affidavit, because there is no copy in existence, apparently, that's part of any official record that contains the complete affidavit.
Your Honor, I'd say that Begley's affidavit is part of the appellate record, which everyone was referring to at trial. Counsel referred to it at page 189 in the appendix. During his cross-examination of Begley, and there was a question as to, I think that given the fact that Begley's affidavit is signed by the magistrate, that is indeed at the appropriate time, that's sufficient evidence that provides Campbell with the notice he required to know what the search warrant was based on.
If that's the way you want us to hold, then isn't the result to essentially nullify the statute, because there's no reason to enforce the statute if every individual gets a copy of the search warrant that's issued against them? There's no reason to determine whatever was filed, or even to file it in circuit court at all, for that matter, is there?
I think the question is whether or not the notice-based requirements of 19.2-54 have been met, and we, in cases like Quintana, we have information in Quintana, the court held that the statutory purpose was served, and that the fact that the magistrate failed to sign the document caused the defendant no prejudice. I would suggest in this case the defendant was not prejudiced, because we have a copy of an affidavit that was presented to the magistrate at the time the warrant was issued and that the magistrate signed off on. And so the statutory purpose of 19.2-54 was satisfied. And in Quintana, the court held that the purpose of the statute was to ensure that the affidavit that the affiant identified the information to which that he was relying in requesting the search warrant. If I could just briefly address the whether or not the officer acted in good faith in relying on the search warrant. It's not clear what Officer Begley could have done differently. He couldn't anticipate the fact that the magistrate's facts would not be properly transmitted to the circuit court. And the state police tactical team who executed the warrant certainly acted in good faith. They had a warrant that had been they had a copy of a warrant that had been endorsed by a magistrate, and they had a complete affidavit attached to it that had also been signed by a magistrate, dated at what appeared to be an appropriate time. And given these facts, the good faith exception certainly applied. There was no evidence that the magistrate was misled. There was no evidence that the magistrate purposefully abandoned his judicial role. I think that looking at the totality of the circumstances, which includes Begley's testimony that he gave all the same information to the magistrate, it includes his signed copy of his affidavit, there's no evidence that that Begley should not have had probable cause, or should that it was unreasonable for Begley to believe that the warrant was properly issued.
Mr. Delfeo, Judge Humphreys again. I don't understand why we even need to get. Maybe you can help me understand why we're even talking about good faith, because nobody seems to be challenging the validity of. Nobody seems to be challenging the existence of probable cause. And the challenge to the validity of the warrant only seems to be with respect to the filing aspects of the statutory requirement. Am I missing something there?
Your Honor, I think the good faith exception argument maybe is easier to answer than the statutory.
My point in that preamble is simply that good faith you only do a good faith analysis under Leon if there's a problem with the warrant. If the warrant it doesn't, in other words, there's a lack of probable cause, but the officers are not lawyers, they're not expected to know that. If a magistrate issues, and they're entitled to act in good faith. We don't have that point here. We don't have an issue of whether probable cause didn't exist, do we? It's simply an issue of whether the statutory requirements for filing it were complied with, and whether or to what extent there's some sanction for that. Isn't that what we're dealing with?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm sorry if I was belaboring the wrong point. And Campbell acknowledged on brief that probable cause did in fact exist. I think that given my earlier argument that the last paragraph does not necessitate that a warrant be invalidated, and given the fact that searches made contrary to Virginia statutes do not provide a right of suppression unless the statute specifically supplies that right, then the trial court, then the search warrant was a valid search warrant. The evidence should not have been excluded.
Mr. Delfeo, thank you very much. Time has elapsed, and we will now move back to Mr. Goad's rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. And Mr. Goad, we're going to add an extra minute to your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Judge. At the end?
Yes, sir.
First, regarding the argument that the statute doesn't expressly state that if you don't file the affidavit within 30 days, then it shall be excluded. That argument adds language to the statute, which would imply that if it is filed at some point after that 30 days, the court has the option to allow the evidence in. Alternatively, if the court were to find that exigent circumstances existed, and that were to take the issue of whether or not this could be, whether or not the evidence was admissible, that would also be adding language to the statute. So that kind of goes to your question earlier about if exigent circumstances existed, why would that not just settle the issue? And I think that's one reason, because the statute is clear and does not say specifically that unless an exception to the warrant requirement applies, then the search shall be invalidated. That was the first point I'd like to make in rebuttal. Second, with respect to the notice requirement, I believe the record shows that the affidavit that Begley had, that was not the affidavit which was in the clerk's office, was provided to me on January 9th, 2015, which was well outside of the 30 days expressly required by statute. Finally, on the issue of good faith, I just like to touch on that briefly. The four times when the good faith exception doesn't apply is when the magistrate's misled by the affiant, the issuing magistrate totally abandoned his judicial role, or the affidavit is so lacking in addition to probable causes to render official belief unreasonable, and four, the warrant is facially deficient. I'm going to set aside number four, but if you look at the affidavit that Begley had, which has no additional hand changes to it, and then the affidavit, and that's signed by the magistrate, and then you look at the affidavit on file in the clerk's office, then you have a magistrate who is signing the affidavit and taking the acknowledgement and then letting the officer go back and add things to it after that has been acknowledged. And we'd argue that that is an abandonment of the judicial role. In closing, I just ask the court to consider arguments that were on brief that weren't presented here today. I ask the court to reverse the ruling of the circuit court admitting the evidence and remand it for further proceedings or finding not guilty.
Thank you, Mr. Goad. Ms. Adelfio, before we go down and greet Mr. Goad, I think I speak for both of my learned colleagues when we wish you all the best for the very short remainder of your pregnancy. Hope the delivery goes very well, and we wish for both a happy and healthy baby and mom.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I appreciate it, and I look forward to seeing you all again, probably in 2017.
Yes, indeed.
It almost sounded like you meant that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor. Have a good one.
You too. Bye.
Nice to meet you, Judge. Thank you for having me.